Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This week, retired UAF Dean and engineer Doug Gearing reflects on a program he helped build.
It's a boom and bust cycle, and I don't think we're going up right now. And I think it's a matter of perception of opportunity in the state and perception of the university right now. I wish it was different, frankly.
And writer and reviewer Frank Sose is back with a look at Sherwood Anderson's neglected masterpiece.
What he focuses on, the turmoil in these characters, and in a way they've all been, let's say, warped out of shape by their experiences in this town in ways that aren't desirable at all.
I hope you'll stick around. This summer on Northern Soundings, I'm running a series of recorded conversations with retired University of Alaska Fairbanks scholars, researchers, and leaders. Our discussions take place live Monday nights in the Murray Auditorium on the UAF campus in a series called Down Memory Lane. The series is hosted by UAF Summer Sessions, and my thanks to it for permission to air these conversations. This week, I talk with engineer and Dean Emeritus Doug Gearing. His connection to the school is multifaceted. He was an undergraduate and graduate student, worked as a research assistant, and then taught and conducted research here on campus. On the practical side, he has several patents out, and his design for keeping permafrost roads stable is proving more successful than imagined. He's a recipient of various awards for his teaching and work, and he helped spearhead a successful program to double the number of engineering undergraduates. And he's been a champion of construction of the new engineering building. But I began our chat with his childhood. His father taught marine science at UAF, and Doug was little more than a toddler the first time he stepped on campus.
The story is an interesting one, which I only remember through the words of my mother, really, because I was too young to remember much directly. My father completed his PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I think around 1961 or so, and took a postdoc in Bermuda. And so we were living in Bermuda for the winter of 61-62. And I think in 62, at some point, he accepted a position here. Which I think, like a lot of Fairbanksans, he assumed was going to be a 1 or 2 or 3 year position. Eventually turned out a lot different than that. And we flew back to my parents' hometown, which is a little place in Kansas, Mound Ridge, Kansas, where they bought a brand new 1962 Rambler station wagon. And we drove that up the Elkan in January of 1963.
Now you have two other brothers?
Right. And only one at that time, and both Greg and I had chicken pox on the Elkan journey. I remember that. My mother recounted a story a number of times of us going into a restaurant somewhere in Canada, trying to hide us from everyone else was there, but she was not entirely successful. And on the way out, one of the other patrons in there tapped her on the shoulder and said, "Can you tell me what your kids have so they'll know what mine have when they get it?"
Now, it wasn't too many years after your arrival here, of course, the flood took place. Do you have any memories of that?
Yeah, I was just 4 when we arrived, and so by that time I was approaching 7 or 8 years old, probably 7, I guess, in the fall of 1967 when that happened. And, you know, the campus was really a haven for the whole community. I think, you know, we at the time lived up on Chandler Drive here on campus. I think the brown duplexes which are up there had been fairly recently built at that time. And so we lived up 1 or 2 houses up from the bottom of Chandler Drive. And I think we had 3 families living with us for a week or more that August. And I remember walking over to the edge of the College Bluff Hill and looking over and just seeing nothing but water. I mean, the water made it all the way up to the intersection of College Road and University. People driving boats around to the staircase that came up the hill.
I've seen pictures, yeah. Must have been remarkable. But kind of exciting for a kid, I'd guess.
Yeah, all but some of the safety measures that we had to endure. Another enduring memory was out in the middle of the quad. Flag Circle was there at the time. It was a little bit different than it is now. But they decided that especially all of the kids needed to have a typhoid immunization. And because there were so many of us, they dispensed with the needles. And they were using a pneumatic injector. And so it's like, chunk, chunk. And there's a line of us, like 100 long. walking slowly, one at a time, up to this gun, basically. That stuck in my mind. I don't think I'll ever forget that.
Yeah, not something I'd forget in a while.
Yeah, so we all got, I think, typhoid immunizations during the flood.
In an earlier interview I did with you, you mentioned your dad was very practical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you might have gotten your interest in mechanical engineering from helping him.
Yeah.
What was that about?
You know, I think my pathway through life was not as convoluted as his in some ways. I mean, I've often wondered, although I never really talked to him about it, how you grow up in a farm in a little town in Kansas and become a marine biologist. You know, it was. but there was some of both of them in him. And so, yeah, you had to remember that he grew up on a farm in Kansas. And he was pretty practical, and he worked on stuff. And that 62 Rambo that I mentioned, every weekend he was down in the garage tinkering with it, doing something with it, you know, changing the spark plugs, tuning it up. I remember one incident where he and I were kibitzing because there was a problem with the car. And it took him a little while to figure it out, but it turned out he had reversed a couple of the spark plug wires. Cars don't run very well when sparks are happening at the wrong time. And I remember driving it up and down Farmers Loop Road, kibitzing with him, what could be wrong? We eventually figured it out. But yeah, that kind of thing had an impact on me. I think that was probably way back when one of the things that led me, at least in part, into mechanical engineering.
Well, obviously, your dad went on to higher education. That must have been a goal for your family. Was education important in your family?
I sort of got that by osmosis, probably. But yeah, I mean, my parents were very supportive of going on, you know, to college and even to graduate school, for sure.
At this time, were you thinking about engineering as a career when you were in high school, or did that happen in college, or how did that happen for you, Doug?
I mean, there were a number of things that occurred in high school that I think, you know, further led me down that path. I had a number of interesting experiences in high school, one of which, we had a very interesting teacher at Lathrop High School at the time who, I don't know if there's anyone in this audience who would know the name, and I'm not even sure I should mention it here because it was a very multifaceted experience, but this guy's name was Reynold Ruger. He was a sociology teacher in high school at Lathrop, and he also ran a motorcycle shop. And he had a very unorthodox high school class, which I was somewhat impressed and a little bit bewildered by. But anyway, in the end, I ended up working at his motorcycle shop, which was known as the Competition Shop. It's completely gone now, but it was on Aurora Drive for a while. And I learned quite a bit there, and that was, you know, towards the end of high school, and I guess it further reinforced my interest in mechanics and doing things with mechanical stuff. But I think it was really my mother. At one point, I remember having a conversation with my mother when we were talking about college, and she said, "Why don't you think about engineering?" And I think I was all set up for the question at that point. And so it was, you know, it all came together. And I didn't have too much question about it when I started school here at UAF that I was going to do likely mechanical engineering.
So I want to talk just a little bit. When you went down to the University of Washington to finish out your undergraduate work, you went for 2 degrees.
Right.
Why? What did the physics give you that the mechanical engineering didn't?
Well, I mean, they go together. I really, really see engineering as, you know, from my perspective anyway, as a sort of the melding of science and mathematics and creativity. I mean, engineering design is a creative activity in my view. And so it's not just simply applying science and math, but applying it in a creative and even artistic way. I mean, that intrigued me. But I realized that probably physics, more than any other science discipline, is really underpins engineering, especially mechanical engineering. And I was interested in physics. And maybe at the time, as an undergraduate student, I wasn't sure if I was going to end up being a professional engineer or what I was going to do. So I hedged my bets by just getting both degrees.
Okay. One of the perks that many people I've interviewed who are past alums here say, small class size, more individualized experience with the instructor, professor, etc. Was that your experience coming back in your master's program?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and it's been my experience all along, even to January, you know, that I think that what UAF can offer engineering students is astounding compared to what you might get at larger engineering schools elsewhere. I mean, there are pluses and minuses, but small class sizes and being able to work in small groups of students with directly with instructors and on hands-on projects, I think in engineering it makes all the difference in the world. And certainly that was true in the master's classes I was taking back in the 80s here on the UAF campus. I mean, we had classes that were quite small, as we do to this day, really, in the graduate programs here.
I know much of your work is on numerical analysis of things like heat transfer and et cetera. Mm-hmm. Let's break some of those out, though, because I think I don't have a clear idea. When you talk about heat transfer, I know thermodynamics is important in physics. How does that apply in this creative venture you call engineering?
You know, in physics classes, you don't learn that much about heat transfer. It's more the application of thermodynamics. So it's, you know, heat transfer, I would say, is more in the realm of engineers, and in particular mechanical engineers, than it is in the realm of physics, probably. Because the fundamental laws that govern heat transfer are fairly simple, but the phenomenon can get very complicated. I mean, a turbulent flow transports heat, right? And turbulence is a very difficult thing to deal with and predict exactly where every eddy is going to move in a complex flow field. So I think it's really the complexity of what the manifestation of some relatively simple laws of physics that heat transfer is all wrapped up in. And it's a very important subject for Alaska. And in fact, you know, maybe I'm getting ahead of the discussion a little bit, but I think one of my advantages was being able to go here as an undergraduate student and as a master's level student and appreciate a lot about Alaska and about the problems that we have here, practical problems with permafrost and other things related to heat transfer, and then go to the University of California and look at more of the theoretical underpinnings and modern tools for dealing with that and putting all that together. And so it was a pleasure to come back and be able to use the whole gamut of theoretical understanding of heat transfer and thermodynamics and the new numerical tools, which were really very new when I was at Berkeley.
Just to follow up briefly, you hold a couple of patents on cooling. Is it time, do you think, Doug, to talk about that dynamics since it went into play? Morris-Thompson Drive, isn't that one of the fruits from that?
Yeah, and I'd say, again, this is an outgrowth of what I just mentioned. You know, some of the heat transfer, convection heat transfer class that I had at the graduate level at Berkeley, we talked about something known as Rayleigh-Bernard convection, which from the physics perspective is a pretty simple problem. You just have this layer of material, you heat it on the bottom, a layer of porous material, mind you, so the fluid or the air or whatever's in there can kind of circulate around. Well, the theoretical Rayleigh-Bernard problem is simply a horizontal layer of this stuff that is heated on the bottom, and that causes the air, or whatever the fluid is, to heat up and become light, and it wants to rise. And so you get this circulation within this layer. And there are theoretical analyses of that problem. And knowing about that from some of the classes I had at Berkeley and then thinking about roadways and thinking about the problems with permafrost and putting all that together is what resulted in those patents. And it's what resulted in Thompson Drive and a number of other projects that we've built and DOT continues to build around the state.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with engineer and former UAF Dean Doug Gehring. When we return from the break, how not to build a fast rail line in the north. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded conversations I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with engineer and Dean Emeritus Doug Gehring. Let's return to the conversation. Well, before we get you to UAF, I'm going to take a side tour to Scandinavia. Mm-hmm. And I note mm-hmm. that you spent a year in Norway.
Yeah.
Was it to see how they were applying things like that?
Yeah, actually it was. It was to see how they were screwing up. And what comes to mind most immediately is this picture, another picture that's sort of indelibly etched in my mind. It was a photograph, mind you, of a Norwegian railway worker standing next to a high-speed rail line just north of Oslo. And it was taken right above the rails. And you can see the guy standing next to the rails in the distance, maybe, I don't know, 50 yards away. And you can see the rail, and the rail looks like this. The Norwegians had this interesting problem where they decided back in the 80s that their airport was too small and it was too close to Oslo. It was built on an island just south of the city of Oslo. So they needed to rebuild the airport. And so they built a new airport. If you fly into Oslo today, you fly into an airport that's roughly 40 kilometers north of downtown Oslo. It's called Gardermoen. Brand new, beautiful airport. But it's a ways away from the downtown Oslo, and they decided, all right, we need to have a high-speed modern rail connection between the airport and downtown Oslo. And so they built a high-speed rail line that was supposed to do 250 kilometers per hour. So, you know, whatever, the 180 miles an hour, something like that, 160 miles an hour. In order to do that, they had to level the rails. So the rails had to be very level. And they blasted through a lot of these granite bluffs. There's a lot of granite around that part of Norway to level everything out. And they used the blast rock to fill in the depressions in the valleys. Well, blast rock, porous material, Rayleigh-Menard problem. And what they didn't understand was that the convection that we talked about, which in Alaska helps preserve permafrost, in Norway caused frost heave. It caused the ground to freeze and expand.
Yeah.
And they never predicted that. They didn't understand that. And so the rails were heaved out of proportion. They were lifted in a very uneven way, just like we have thaw settlement here that's very uneven in our roadways. They had kind of the opposite problem, but it had the same effect. The rails looked like this, and the trains, which were supposed to be doing...
And you don't want a 180 mile per hour...
No, in fact, the trains were creeping along the tracks at 25 miles an hour, and the Norwegian rail lines had a big black eye. And one of the researchers there had been reading my papers and invited me to come there for sabbatical. So we spent a year in Oslo on sabbatical. So mostly I worked with them on that, and we did a number of investigations of the type of material they were using in the embankments and why it would cause this enhanced freezing to occur.
Talk a little bit about the engineering department and how you saw it develop over time.
Well, you know, when I was an undergraduate here, back in the late 70s, I guess, I graduated from what was called West Lathrop at the time.
What would eventually become West Valley.
Right, yeah. So in 1975 and 76, they actually had to split shift Lathrop High School. And there was one whole high school, East Lathrop, that went to school from 6 a.m. until noon. And another whole high school, whole group, different group of students, different group of teachers, sort of out with the morning crew, in with the afternoon crew, and we went to school from 1 p.m. until 6 p.m.
Wow.
And that was because there was so much expansion in Fairbanks in the mid-70s because of the pipeline activity. They just couldn't grow the infrastructure fast enough. So anyway, I graduated in 76 from West Lathrop, which was the afternoon session of the high school, and came to school here for the next 2 years. And, you know, the department back then was very small. I think mechanical engineering, I don't remember the exact year it got going, but I think it was in the early 70s. So the ME department had theoretically only been there for, you know, probably 5 years or so at the time I started. And there were several key professors there, but the two that had the biggest influence on me, even at the time as an undergraduate student, and even more so later on, were Jim Tiedemann and John Zarling. And I had classes from both of them then in the late. And I had a class from Eb Rice as well, who was a fairly well-known Arctic engineering. Mm. He was one of the first ones that really pointed to permafrost problems and made them fairly well-known. So between Eb Rice and John Zarling and Jim Tiedemann, I had wonderful experiences in my first 2 years as an undergraduate student here at UAF. But, you know, like a lot of Fairbanks kids, I had grown up in Fairbanks. I'd been here since I was 4 years old. I was, you know, a little bit interested in going somewhere else. And Zarling, I talked a little bit, and he ended up writing some letters of recommendation for me, and I ended up at UW, where I eventually got my undergraduate degrees from.
Well, about this time, the computers are coming online.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that affect engineering?
Well, the first experience I had was when I was at the University of Washington. My roommate at the time was a budding computer geek. And he had a computer in our dorm room that was built by a company which is long gone now called Ohio Scientific. And they used to build one-board computers with a processor on there that was known as the 6502 microprocessor. And this computer, you didn't get a computer when you ordered it, you got a motherboard. And somehow there was a keyboard attached to it. But you, in order to see anything, you had to plug it into like a TV set. And in order to store programs, you had to record them on cassette tapes with an audio cassette player. And the only program he had, I think, that I remember anyway, was Space Invaders. So we played Space Invaders on this thing. And at the time, I guess I started to realize that they had a lot of potential in science and engineering. And more so a few times when I went with this guy to the local University of Washington computer club. There was a computer club there. And I remember they were doing interesting projects. At one point, they had some actuators and were using one of these simple computers to point a laser. And while I don't remember him, this friend of mine, Craig, my roommate, says that Bill Gates was actually one of the people in that computer club early on. And this was before, you know, MS-DOS or Microsoft or any of that stuff. It would have been probably in 1977, something like that. So early on, I guess I was interested, and I learned these things were things that you programmed in BASIC, which was the, you know, they had a
the
BASIC,
language,
the language BASIC, yeah. And we started using them for some of the projects that we were doing. Was it clear to me how ubiquitous they would become and how important they would become in engineering at the time? Probably not. By the time I got to be a graduate student at Berkeley, there was a fledgling field known as computational fluid dynamics that was just being enabled by the latest hardware. In fact, Berkeley had, at the time, one of the fastest machines in the country, a fairly new Cray XMP. You know, PCs had been around. The IBM PC was around by that point because this was the mid to late 80s. But the PC at that point was, you know, not very powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, the very first IBM PC had to put those floppies in.
Floppy, you know? Yeah, I remember those.
But big computers were becoming more and more capable, and we started to be able to solve real fluid dynamics problems with computers, which wasn't possible probably until the late 70s, early 80s with the very fastest computers. And by the mid 80s, it was plausible for grad students to actually program these things and solve fluid mechanics problems. So by the time I got into my PhD program, it was pretty apparent that these were extremely important. Although I would say at the time, this field of computational fluid dynamics was really the realm of engineering research, not so much practitioners. Now it's in the realm of practitioners. There's lots of different types of programs out there that will solve all sorts of kinds of flow problems for you, including turbulent flow, which is very complex flow fields.
Richard Feynman, in one of his books, says they got a computer back when they were developing the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And he said a lot of researchers would get so enamored about the possibilities, it was like a black hole, or, you know, they'd be lost to real important research because they were futzing around with this new computer.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that an issue with engineers too?
I would say certainly with some engineers that are really interested in that. You know, and for a while, especially while I was trying to get my PhD dissertation done, I was probably in that category. But I would say it still comes back to they're just tools.
I'm of such an age that I still remember slide rules.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
There's a curmudgeon now that's emerged out of my more senior moments saying, those kids today, they got those computers, they should do it with a slide rule.
Yeah.
Do you worry about?
I think it's a concern because, I mean, the software is pretty powerful. I would say that software developers have gotten better about putting warning flags in there because they realize that not all of the folks that are using those programs are going to have the background necessary to really understand the tool that well and know when there are potentially numerical problems, for instance. These days, actually, even more has been taken out of the engineer's hands and been built into this software package, so much so that the software package itself watches over what's going on and says, oh, we need more grid points, we need more cells, we need more time steps, we need more something here to make sure this solution is accurate. So I think the tools have gotten a little bit better about sending up warning flags if they're being applied inappropriately. But I think it's a danger, and you know, so when, you know, whenever I teach engineering classes, and I think most of the faculty here at UAF teach engineering classes, we truly try to focus on the basics. I mean, you want to be able to produce a back of the envelope solution for an engineering problem, and if your numerical simulation is showing somewhere over here, you know, you want to have some benchmarks to make sure that you're getting things that make sense out of those software packages.
You mentioned this, but I have to ask about material science. Now that they have 3D printers, is that like, oh, now we can build it from the molecule up?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the technology you're referring to in some general sense is referred to as additive manufacturing, right? You take something and you add pieces to it. Potentially, those pieces could be molecules. And we, more and more, we have the tools for doing that, even at the atomic scale. One of the researchers we had in mechanical engineering when I was department chair was a material scientist, and she worked a lot with an atomic force microscope, which I didn't really know much about. But, you know, my interpretation of it, probably oversimplified, is that it's a very, very fine whisker that you use to run over, literally run the whisker over atoms in a substrate to feel what's there and get a picture of what's there.
Wow.
But you can also use that whisker to push things on the atomic scale. And so there are ways of manufacturing very small things, and there are easy ways of manufacturing, you know, prototype scale things that our students are using today that you couldn't do even 10 years ago. There's a push on campus, which I hope we're able to accomplish, to buy a metal 3D printer. I know that the GI is interested in that, and so is engineering. Money's a little tight right now.
Yeah, you think?
And they're expensive.
Yeah.
But it would be really neat to be able to print metal part. And it's something that attracts students to engineering. I mean, a lot of students that go into engineering really like building stuff, and that's an easy way to build stuff, is you just print it.
Yeah. Let me turn then to your work as an administrator and dean. I've talked to a number of academics and researchers that found that they were actually very good at doing this kind of work. When did you think, you know, I could serve in this capacity too?
Yeah, I don't know if there was a light bulb that came on. I guess to a certain extent I found it somewhat natural because I can talk with people. I mean, generally, I get along with people pretty well, which I think is one skill that you definitely need. And, you know, the department chairmanship is an elected position here at UAF, so you have to have the colleagues in your department elect you.
Is this where bribes and graft?
Well, hopefully not. In fact, you know, I would say there's probably a number of reluctant department chairs on campus, and I was probably one of them for a while. But, you know, I found that just like working on these heat transfer problems, that, it, you know, you could take a logical approach to managing the department, and it worked, you know. And I remember I got some satisfaction out of just managing the budget and worked with our departmental admin. In fact, set up a spreadsheet, something we called a soft ledger, so that I knew, in some sense, as much or more about our budget and where the numbers were than even the dean's office did. And in fact, I remember having a conversation with one of the deans before we became the College of Engineering and Mines. So this would have been CSEM, the College of Science, Engineering, and Math. And I can't actually remember who was dean at the time. It would have been in the early 2000s.
Mm.
And I got called up to the dean's office because they were watching the budget and they were afraid at what was happening. So I and our department admin went up there with the soft ledger in my back pocket. And I said, well, see, this is what's really going on. It ended up being a short, satisfying meeting. And so anyway, I enjoyed the mechanics, at least, of running the department. And I enjoyed the people in the department. And so it just became something easy and comfortable to do.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm airing a recording of a public conversation I had with former UAF Dean Doug Gehring. And when we return from the break, we'll talk about exigency and engineering. listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This episode, I'm airing my conversation with engineer and Dean Emeritus Doug Gehring. The night of our discussion occurred just after the UA Board of Regents declared financial exigency, and that subject found its way into our conversation. Well, a couple of notable things that you helped achieve was expanding the number of engineering students, and then helping get that new facility up and running and the funds in place for that. Yeah. So let's break a couple of those out. Obviously, because you were received several awards from the students, you were great at communicating with students. When you are trying to expand the number of engineering students, what do you say? What are some of the things you would address in achieving that end?
Yeah, I mean, I think my direct influence on, you know, recruiting, if you will, new students was minimal because there's only so many students the dean can talk to. I just didn't have that much time or that many venues where I ran across students. But I tried to do my best to go to the UA Scholars events and, you know, talk with students. Certainly whenever students came by the college and wanted to talk with the dean, I was more than happy to do that. And I would usually talk to them about all the neat things that we do in engineering and that we do in engineering here at UAF. I'd talk with them about the projects, the hands-on projects that our students work on, you know, including launching satellites and you know, building bridges and designing other stuff and having access to 3D printers and UAVs. I mean, there were just a whole plethora of really neat projects that the engineering students here on this campus got involved in. And I think much more so than some of the bigger institutions outside, just because we didn't have that much of a huge ratio of students to projects. You know, our ratio of students to projects was somewhat smaller than you might have seen, than I saw when I was at UW, for instance.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing I would talk with them about, is about what you can do with engineering and what you can do here at UAF with your hands and the machine shop and build stuff. And that appealed to a lot of them, not all of the engineering students. I mean, there are some engineering students that are interested in a professional career first and foremost. But most of the students that go into engineering also have this interest in tinkering, you know, and building things. And I think that makes for a good engineer.
I've often heard scientists bemoan the fact that American kids aren't drawn to the sciences. How about engineering?
The situation is interesting in engineering. It's not so much a problem, I would say, at the undergraduate level because it's perceived as a good profession. I mean, I'm not so sure about our state right now, what the opportunities are, but in most of the places in the U.S., there are plenty of opportunities when you graduate from college with a Bachelor of Science in Engineering. Mm. And students at most other institutions are getting, you know, plenty of job offers. And so I think, you know, there's not a problem typically, I don't think anyway, attracting American students to engineering, at least at the undergraduate level. Not as much as the sciences might have. And again, I think it's because it's perceived as a good career path and it is. I mean, there's statistics to back that up.
Sure.
Where it is a problem, though, is that you can do so much with an undergraduate degree in engineering, with a bachelor's degree in engineering, that students bug out at that point. So where it is a problem in engineering is at the graduate level. And if you look at the graduate student population in engineering in the U.S., it's largely students from overseas. I don't know what the exact numbers are. And the reason is simply because once they get a BS degree, engineering students have so many opportunities. They think, well, I'm not going to go to school anymore. I'm going to go get a job and make a bunch of money. And so I think that's more the problem that we have in engineering, is keeping American students involved in engineering research and advanced studies.
Mm-hmm. And the other point, and it kind of dovetails with what you're saying, is this new facility. What does it provide you that the old labs and the old venues didn't?
Well, I mean, there were a few things that we worked on with the architects. One was trying to keep engineering as visible as possible. So there's at least more, I'd say still not enough, but there's at least more glass in that building. There's more opportunities to see what students and engineers are doing in the various labs and whatnot than there is in Duck Ring. I mean, Duck Ring is a dungeon compared to the new building. You can't really tell what's going on in Duck Ring. You can't see anything. And so we had a couple of successes there, I would say. But it, you know, I think more than anything else, the new building provides more opportunities for hands-on engineering. I mean, we have purposely put a brand new machine shop in that building that's significantly larger than the old one that we had in Duck Ring. And adjacent to that machine shop are student workspaces where students work on real projects with some oversight from the machine shop staff. And then there's a number of brand new laboratories in that building. So really, I would say that from the undergraduate and even to a certain extent the graduate student perspective, we focused on hands-on engineering when the building was designed. And I think it really does allow a lot more of that than Duck Ring does. At the graduate student level, we designed a number of suites where graduate students can sit more in close proximity to faculty. So there's more easy interaction between graduate students and the faculty that are supervising them. And then there is also a number of new research bays in the building as well, including the structural high bay, which has lots of capabilities. And
that's very visible.
Yeah, it's very visible. And you know, I'm hoping that we'll have large projects in there soon. Mm. We are still in the process of acquiring equipment to be able to load bridge structures and things like that. If you look in there today, you'll see there's some actuators that are sitting on the floor in there that are still being set up. But there's also a number of environmental and other types of labs in the building. So there's a significant research focus and a significant hands-on engineering focus to the new building.
The other thing is you really spearheaded efforts to see it realized. So you must have, over time, as a dean or as an administrator, learned a little bit about fundraising, learning about networking, or would that be right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that that's one thing that I didn't know anything about certainly as a department chair was, and mostly it was learning about the political process in the state because it was largely state funded with state capital funds, not entirely, unfortunately, but largely. And I'll never forget though, it was probably former speaker in the series, Joan Braddock, that first put a bug in my ear and maybe Dan White's ear as well. Dan and I were working pretty closely at the time together. You know, this building was in the request phase, I would say, in the late 2000s. And at one point, Joan said, "Seems like engineering's growing here quite a bit. Have you ever thought about a new building?" And that was probably in maybe 2007 or 2008. And it was timed well because in 2006 or 2007, soon after, I think it was before I became permanent dean, then President Hamilton declared that UA was going to double the number of engineering graduates coming out of the University of Alaska system. And we were going to do it by 2012. And in fact, I mean, Susan's here. Susan might argue with me on this, but I think we met that goal, or we were darn close anyway to doubling the number of engineering graduates. And engineering from 2005 to 2010 or 11 was just growing like gangbusters. When I took over as interim dean in 2006, we probably had between 500 and 550 students. By 2011, 2012, we had over 1,000. And mechanical engineering had gone from 80 students to 250. I mean, it was just incredible, the growth. And so it was natural to think about, all right, where are we going to house all these students? How are we going to teach them? And so in the late 2000s, we started talking about new facilities for engineering here on this campus. And mind you, at the same time, UAA was doing the same thing. Mm. And I remember probably around that time, 2008, 2009, I started listening, which I'd never done before, to testimony before the House and Senate Finance Committees on the capital budget. And UAA was doing a pretty good job of advocating there for their needs. And I thought, well, you know, if we're going to get an engineering building, we're going to have to do this. And so anyway, I started working with folks in the college probably in around the 2009 timeframe, including some of our students, and said, you know, if we want a new engineering facility, we're going to have to be ready to advocate in front of the Senate Finance Committee for capital funds for this thing. And we had some helpful supporters. Senator Johnny Ellis was a big supporter of engineering, and he helped get initial funding through for building planning. So it was learning about that political process and listening to testimony and the testimony before the House and Senate Finance Committees that made me think we need to do this too. And I think we were able to organize mostly our students to send messages in at key moments. I never forget a conversation late Senator Mike Kelly once told me that he got a bunch of input from CEM engineering students at the exact right time. And I think it was the spring 2010 legislative session that made it possible to get the initial staunch of money for both the engineering building at UAA and this one here.
Given that the Board of Regents just voted for exigency, yeah, which is pretty grim, I can't let you go without asking you to reflect, because you put a lot of effort in to see build up this thing.
You know, it's obviously it's very disappointing to see the minimal level of support that the university is getting from the current administration. But it's also just disappointing to see what's happening in the economy in the state. I mean, that's driving a lot of it. You know, and I don't know if there's anything any of us can do about it, but it seems like there's not as much opportunity right now as there was 5-10 years ago. And, you know, I think that's forcing some students to think about going elsewhere. I mean, students go into engineering to get jobs, and I think the perception now is it's not going to be that easy to get a job in Alaska once I get my engineering degree here. So I think there's a conspiracy of a lot of things that are not going in the right direction right now. But, you know, Alaska always does this. And, you know, I can say that for sure because I've watched the petroleum engineering enrollments. They really
go
do this.
That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, so we'll come back, but right now is certainly not a very good time for the university. And I still think that, I certainly am hopeful that there'll be some movement in what happens to university funding this year. I think there will be. Mm-hmm. But I think no matter what happens, even if there's a partial reprieve, it's going to be a very challenging financial year for the UA system, for sure. And the declaration of financial exigency today is obviously one sign of that.
A lot of the people that I've been able to talk to in this series seem it's very hard to pry them loose from their life's work. How about you after retirement? What are you up to?
Well, you know, like I said a little bit earlier, I've gone back to looking at some of the data from Thompson Drive, and it's been quite interesting. You know, there's a bunch of data logging stations down there that were installed when the road was built in 2005. And I've religiously collected the data down there ever since then. We have hourly temperatures.
Those data sets must be getting
larger.
They're
huge. Yeah. Although, you know, the computer capacity grows faster than data, that much I've learned. So it's, you know.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Manageable.
So I've been looking at the data from Thompson Drive. And the systems that were put in down there, both the convection systems and the thermosiphons that probably most of you are aware of, because you drive over that thing at certain times during the winter, you see all those stripes in the road.
Mm-hmm.
Those are hairpin thermosiphons that are buried beneath the asphalt down there. Both systems are working well. And despite the fact that we've had, I would say, nearly a record run of warm years, the last 5 years, every single year has been extremely warm, at least according to the air temperature sensors down there on Thompson Drive. But despite that, the road, the foundation soils beneath that road have actually gotten colder. When we built that road back in the mid-2000s, it was permafrost. It's frozen, but barely so. The temperatures were between minus 0.1 centigrade, minus 0.2 centigrade, I mean, just a fraction of a degree below freezing. And over the last 10 or 15 years, this cold wave has propagated from the base of the embankment downward. And temperatures beneath that embankment now are more like minus 0.8 degrees centigrade, which is a substantial cooling. And we're talking, you know, 30 to 40 feet down from where the roadway is. In fact, so much so that I understand that cold climate housing center is having water issues now. And I suspect what's happening is Thompson Drive has become a dam because the permafrost layer has moved up into the base of the roadway, and so now the groundwater can't go that way. So anyway, there's other people in engineering.
Thanks, mechanical engineering.
Yeah, right. So anyway, it's you know, the I guess what I've seen so far and looking at this data carefully is that the cooling systems down there are working quite well, and so far they're capable of overcoming our warm winters. But according to those instruments down there, we have not had a winter since in the last 5 years where the mean air temperature there was below freezing. The mean air temperature has been above freezing every single year down there on Thompson Drive since 2014. which is astounding because the long-term average air temperature for Fairbanks is typically quoted as around 26 Fahrenheit or 27 Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. several degrees below freezing.
I happen to see you sporting a big backpack walking up Esther Dome Road not long ago.
Not just me, my wife's in law too. Well, I mean, that was a practice for the Chilkoot. So we a few weeks ago, we just did the Chilkoot Trail and thoroughly enjoyed it. Lucked out, didn't get rained on at all. It was a beautiful trip, although I would say for anyone who hasn't done it, it's a demanding hike. It's a fairly rough trail, most of it, not just the Golden Staircase, but the rest of it is not exactly a sidewalk. But it was a very enjoyable trip. That's what that was all about, is trying to get ready to carrying 30 or 40 pounds up a steep hill.
Yeah.
Esther Dome's great for that practice.
Well, the other thing I understand is when you were younger, you were a standout swimmer. Are you still swimming today?
Yeah, I've been a swimmer since I was 10 years old. And you know, when I was in graduate school at Berkeley, I swam on a master swim team. I never swam on a college swim team because when I was going to school here for the first 2 years as a freshman and a sophomore, UAF didn't have a swim team at that point. And to this, now we have a women's swim team. For a while in the early 70s, there was both a men's and a women's swim team here. But mm-hmm. by the time I got to UAF in 76 or 77, there wasn't a swim team. So anyway, I never swam college. But I swam in Alaska age group championships forever, all through high school, and held a couple of state records for a while. But these days I continue to swim either on a master swim team or regularly with one of my colleagues here from the GI. Robbie and I were just in the pool at noon today, for instance, flailing around.
Oh yeah, flailing. I always give the audience an opportunity to ask some questions. So transitioning in these challenging times, attracting kids to campus and engineering.
I think there's always going to be a segment of high school graduates that are really interested in engineering. And, you know, one of the things I tried to do as dean is institute programs that reached out to them. One of them, which I thought was effective anyway, was high school robotics programs. And I think you went to several of those events. You know, that really charges up. I mean, I was a believer in the carrot approach to getting students interested in engineering, and having them fool with robotics at the high school level was one way to do that. I think those things will remain effective. I think the problem we're experiencing now, and I haven't seen the latest numbers, but I do believe that engineering enrollments both here and at UAA are probably declining right now. And the things that are going on in the state make a difference. And the perception of students and parents especially, you know, what are the opportunities here in Alaska are, you know, going downhill. And one thing that really doesn't help is having the university beat about the forehead in the media. And so all the talk of, you know, budget cuts and real budget cuts is probably going to turn some families and potential students away to go to school elsewhere in the country. That's a real loss. I mean, I think that the things that we did in engineering here, and hopefully will continue to do successfully, is, you know, we mostly educated Alaskans. And if we didn't educate Alaskans, they were Alaskans by the time they got their degree, because they knew darn good and well what it was like to live in Fairbanks, Alaska. You know, BP can't hire people from California that know what it's like to live in Alaska. And we also injected in them some sense of Arctic engineering and the knowledge of how to engineer stuff in Alaska. Very important for Alaskan companies. And just, I think, just engendered an appreciation for students. I mean, I think a lot of them, it was, you know, Alaska's a love it or hate it place. And the people that we tended to attract were people that kind of liked being here. And consequently, they were very valuable as potential employees for Alaskan industry. It's a boom and bust cycle. And I don't think we're going up right now. And I think it's a matter of perception of opportunity in the state and perception of the university right now. Mm. I wish it was different, frankly.
I have a question here someone just handed me about that they suggested building a subway around Alaska and wondered what you thought of that and whether that was a worthy goal.
I mean, there've been talks of building intercontinental connections, you know, like under the Bering
Siberian,
Sea.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those things can be done, and to a certain extent we do them already. I mean, we build underground utilidors even in Barrow. You know, I think the place where subways for human transport make the most sense are in heavily urbanized areas where surface real estate is either completely booked up or incredibly expensive. I don't know if we've gotten that to that point anywhere in Alaska yet, but if we do, I think it's a perfectly viable thing to be able to do that, even to a certain extent if you try to do it in frozen soils. It's a little bit more of a challenge if you have to deal with permafrost, certainly, to build something underground. But I think it's a matter of economics, whether it makes sense to move that infrastructure underground because the surface infrastructure is so valuable.
Mm. Okay. Well, I want to take this opportunity to thank you, Dr. Doug Gehring, for coming by and talking with us this evening.
Well, thank you, Robert.
Links to the School of Engineering and summer sessions are on the Northern Soundings website. My thanks to Michelle Bartlett and Summer Sessions for permission to air the discussions. When we return from the break, Frank Sos reviews a book seeing its 100th anniversary. Welcome back. Writer and reviewer Frank Sos is in, and he says Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio fell from favor with readers and critics for a period of time. But all that's changed. The book is seeing its 100th anniversary this year, and here's Frank reading a selection.
The old writer, like all of the people in the world, had got, during his long life, a great many notions in his head. He had once been quite handsome, and a number of women had been in love with him. And then, of course, he had known people, many people, known them in a peculiar, intimate way that was different from the way in which you and I know people. At least that is what the writer thought, and the thought pleased him. Why quarrel with an old man concerning his thoughts? In the bed, the writer had a dream that was not a dream. As he grew somewhat sleepy but was still conscious, figures began to appear before his eyes. He imagined the young, indescribable thing within himself was driving a long procession of figures before his eyes. You see, the interest in all this lies in the figures that went before the eyes of the writer. They were all grotesques. All of the men and women the writer had ever known had become grotesques. The grotesque were not all horrible. Some were amusing, some almost beautiful, and one, a woman all drawn out of shape, hurt the old man by her grotesqueness. When she passed, he made a noise like a small dog whimpering. Had you come into the room, you might have supposed the old man had unpleasant dreams, or perhaps indigestion.
Frank Sos, reading from Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Frank, I'm guessing this isn't a recent novel because Sherwood Anderson's been around for a while, right?
Yeah. In fact, he's been dead for a while.
Dead for a while, too,
yeah.
Yes.
This is the centennial of this novel's publication. It came out in 1919, and it's probably the most significant book that Sherwood Anderson published. He published memoirs, he published poems, he published other novels, and he published some very good short stories. But this is one volume of what critics often call a short story sequence. The stories all are set in Winesburg. The character George Willard is present, not in every single one of them, but you realize he's sort of the presiding character, and most of what we know through him.
Mm. Help me, before we turn to the characters and incidents described in the book, where Sherwood Anderson lies in American letters. Is he before Hemingway?
Oh, yeah, indeed. In fact, he was a promoter of the young Hemingway and the young William Faulkner. Neither one of them were especially grateful to him later in life and wrote parodies of him. His career really never reached the level of theirs. And for a good number of years, Winesburg, Ohio was pretty much set aside, and then gradually critics said, you know, this is a fairly important American novel. And it is. It's a novel of small-town American life. Even though it's set in 19, it's very consciously anachronistic of itself, because in Winesburg, there are no phones. There are no cars. It's a pre-industrial, small, northern Ohio town.
Is there nostalgia at work here, Frank? Why look back on a small town? What is he aiming for?
Well, that's really, a useful and maybe the question for a book of this type, because the portrait of Winesburg is not altogether flattering. Yes, it's a town where a person can make a living being a harness maker, a carriage painter, a sign painter, a telegraph operator, a house painter, all these jobs that are fairly small-time, you know, store clerks, sustain people. And, of course, they're going to be blown aside by the industrial age that's just already happening, as he writes. So in some regards, I think Sherwood Anderson would mourn the passing of that life, where crops were picked by young men and women and were ridden out to the fields in a horse and wagon every morning and back. On the other hand, life in Winesburg is terrifically stultifying. Most people are trapped in different ways. Some of them are trapped by their past. Some of them are trapped by their desires. All of them would want for more than Winesburg seems to be able to deliver.
Mm. You know, a lot of writers, I'm thinking here of Joyce in Dublin and Faulkner in his Mississippi, places as important element in any narrative as the characters that inhabit it. And it sounds like Winesburg, Ohio is similar in that regard.
It is. It is, although it's not necessarily so much the Ohio-ness as the townness that is what makes it what it is. It's a book about small town life and readily translatable to a small town in the southern Appalachians or on the East Coast or even on the Pacific Coast, if the town is small, compact enough so that you feel like you're familiar to many people.
Are there modern editions of Anderson available? Because I'm looking at yours, Frank, and it's been around the block a while.
Oh, yeah. This is the modern library edition, bought for me by my mother at Holy's Bible Bookstore in Bluefield, West Virginia, because she read probably in Women's Day that this would be a good book for your child who's going to college to have read. And it was. It sort of made me see my town as richly as I could see it, and it made me appreciate my town in an interesting sort of way. This volume, Winesburg, Ohio, the volume is easily gotten, and newish collected stories edited by a very good contemporary writer, Charles Baxter, is out there too, and I would really commend those stories as well. That's Anderson's skill. You can't call this a novel. It very much is a bunch of linked stories. Many characters just appear in their own story and then they disappear and we never hear from them again. What he focuses on, as that little intro passage I read suggests, is the turmoil in these characters. And in a way, they've all been, let's say, warped out of shape by their experiences in this town in ways that aren't desirable at all.
Frank Soos is an award-winning writer. His most recent collection is On Pleasantries, published by University of Washington Press, and he reviews books here on Northern Soundings. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Robert.
That's it for this Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next week when I talk with anthropologist Phyllis Morrow. Thanks for listening.